ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Data centres are not digging anything up. They're not exploiting resources that are owned by the Australian people, but they certainly shouldn't be getting concessional prices for the electricity they use.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party: change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Ngunnawal country here in Parliament House, Canberra.
And there you are again. I'm Fran Kelly here on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. And PK, this week the news has gone global. We've got the war back on, it would seem, the US-Iran war, the conflict, that peace deal was short-lived at sea. We'll see how this plays out. But Donald Trump has certainly upped the rhetoric, labelling the Iranian leadership as scum. And here in Australia, we've got a visit by the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. He's going to meet with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese today. They're going to have the India Annual Leaders Summit. There's plenty to discuss. And most of the week, in fact, the PM has been out and about talking to other leaders. He's been on, I think we could safely call it a Pacific blitz. He's met with, it's kind of like speed dating for leaders. He's met with five Pacific leaders in just 3 days. He signed a mutual defence alliance with Fiji. We're going to hear more about that. And then, of course, in the midst of that tour of the Pacific, China decided to test a nuclear-capable long-range ballistic missile. Guess where? Right in the middle of the Pacific. And we're going to get into all of that with our man on the spot, ABC Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts.
Yeah, but it's interesting that, Fran, while all of this international news is unfolding, as you say, from the theatre of the Iran war back on to our own region, and obviously having someone as you know, incredibly large a figure as Narendra Modi in the country, the biggest story, I reckon, emerging is the Telstra outage.
Yeah, right. All politics is local, right?
Right, absolutely. And also so real for people, right? You can't run your business because you can't run your transactions. The trains are down. You can't do basic texting of your grandmother. Like, this is a really big issue. It's getting worse, not better, which is also a problem, with more, you know, more cases coming to light of as being part of the outage in relation to the 000 calls, which we'll get into. And then the Prime Minister's podcast blunder. He has now apologised unequivocally for going on a podcast talking about his sex life in a way that I'm still recovering from. Let's bring in Stephen Jedgetts. He's the ABC's Foreign Affairs Asia Pacific reporter. I don't think he's desperate to talk about the Prime Minister's sex life. I think we want to stick with some foreign affairs.
Confirmation.
Come on, Stephen,
I am not. No. Please,
you
God.
Only live once,
no.
Look, I'm going to save you from yourself. It's great to have you join us. You've been two steps behind the Prime Minister, literally, on this Pacific blitz all week. We're going to come to all of that, but the bilateral talks with his Indian counterpart, Prime Minister Narendra Modi, in Melbourne. Now, last time he was here, the Indian Prime Minister got a rock star reception, and there's another big show tonight at the Marvel Stadium. Now,
I love the title of this show, Pika.
Go tell us.
Melbourne meets Modi. Mm. I mean, it's sort of got it all, hasn't
well,
it?
Well, it's an alliteration. 30,000 people are expected to attend. It's good. It's a big deal, but there's pressure on the Prime Minister to raise human rights issues. I mean, that's always a perennial issue, isn't it, when you deal with, you know, a leader of a country that's as complex as India.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the story of Modi, right? On the one hand, he's undoubtedly, you know, one of the most transformational leaders that India's had, you know, post-independence. And you ask people in the Indian community, you know, why do you like Modi? And they say basically a version of, oh, he's made me proud to be of Indian heritage. They're proud of the fact that India is now standing tall on the international stage. They're proud that, you know, India under Modi has undergone an astonishing transformation. You look at the clean energy boom, you look at the infrastructure boom. You know, it is an incredible series of achievements, but there's also a flip side, right? And there are two main things that critics talk about here, including in the Indian diaspora in Australia. You know, there are plenty of Modi critics in this group as well. One, there's a question about human rights more broadly, increasing pressure on the media, on the courts and those institutions that are really meant to, you know, stabilise and ground Indian democracy. And then there's the question of the treatment of minorities, in particular religious minorities. India is, after all, a secular democracy. It's got, you know, several hundred million Muslims that are in the country, along with a Hindu majority. But human rights groups have argued, you know, in some cases very persuasively, that Muslims are simply not treated as they should be in India, that there has been a systematic erosion of their human rights. Now, the question is, will Anthony Albanese raise it? My feeling is that he will, but in the most pro forma way possible. Because the reality is, like, as India becomes more indispensable to us, right, and as the gap, let's be real, the gap between, you know, their economic and military power and ours grows, and it will continue to grow, we are going to be a smaller and smaller fish compared to India as it becomes a major power. You know, our interests are pretty deeply entrenched here. We're going to feel like we have less and less space to really lean in on issues like human rights, because India is just so important to us, even more so in the Trump era when everything is up in the air.
So they're going to have a sit down today. It's an important bilateral meeting. What is the Prime Minister, what is our Prime Minister hoping to get from this visit? Because it was really notable last visit when Narendra Modi was here last time, how close our Prime Minister seemed to be or wanted to be. He was really, there was a really sense that he was sort of basking in the diaspora glow, if you like, during Modi's visit. And to the point where he got some criticism for, you know, some of his behaviour like this. But nevertheless, Stephen, as you say, India has a lot to offer Australia. I feel like we've been saying that for the last 30 years. I've been reporting on bilateral trade talks with India, and it's been talked up as critical for the Australian economy and a key, you know, part of our sort of future economic growth. It hasn't really delivered. How have things changed and what is on the table particularly?
So a couple of things first. First, India is on track to probably be the third largest economy in the world, right? Eventually. There are arguments about when this is going to happen, but it seems inevitable that just sheer weight of numbers and demography is going to carry India through to that position. It'll be after, you know, China and the US, but it'll be India after that at some point. Second thing is that, yeah, our economic relationship has always been underdone. We have seen over the last few years a real boom in that in that trading relationship. So our trade has grown substantially over the last 3-4 years in particular, including after we signed a sort of 85% there partial trade agreement with them of about 3-4 years ago. But it's still too narrowly based. We're still selling pretty much the same things. We're just getting, you know, we're selling more of it typically and getting more money. So what we're trying to do here is diversify. And doing that is just much, much harder to do than it is to say. What are we going to see out of these talks? A few things. I mean, it's clear that the Indian side is very focused on critical minerals and things like lithium, but also uranium. You know, we are basically expecting the government to sign, you know, essentially a legal instrument or a series of legal instruments that are going to make it easier for uranium to be exported to India. In theory, we've been able to do this since 2015. I'm sure you both remember the furious debate on the Labor side of politics under Rudd and particularly under Gillard over whether we should do this or not. Mm. That bridge has been crossed.
Because it's nuclear armed, right?
Yeah, and India has a new, and when India started testing missiles, you know, in 1998, Australia responded furiously, which set the relationship well back on its haunches. Anyway, ancient history.
Ancient history, yes, and the laws have been changed. And finally, basically, I think the infrastructure is getting in place for this trade to happen. That's one thing. But it's not just the boom in renewable energy that's happened that we're interested in. There's also been boom here. I mean, India is the world's most populous country. I think it's got a huge, huge population. And we've seen something happen here that is in tandem with that. People born in India are now Australia's biggest source of migrants, narrowly overtaking England. That's new. And that has occurred at this moment where one nation is on the rise. Pauline Hanson is damning multiculturalism and immigration levels in Australia. She's tapping into a significant anxiety in our community around immigration levels. According to a recent Lowy poll, 55% of respondents, that's Australians, say the number of migrants coming here is too high. and there's been a 17 percentage point plunge in the share of people who say cultural diversity is good for the country. That's from 90% 2 years ago to 73% now. That's pretty significant. So in the midst of all this hoo-ha and, you know, Modi's here and Melbourne meets Modi kind of fervour and fever, our Prime Minister is going to be there on stage with Modi at a time when Australians are looking on and thinking, a lot of us don't really like all these migrants coming. It's a different climate for this visit in terms of domestic politics for our Prime Minister, isn't it? Do you think he's how attuned to this do you think he is, Stephen? Have you seen any evidence of that on this trip?
Look, not yet, only because it's just kicking off. But I agree it's going to be a fascinating line for Anthony Albanese to walk. And I think he is. I mean, unsurprisingly, the Prime Minister, I'm sure you guys know this better than me, he's got a pretty good political antennae and he's pretty attuned to this stuff. I would be staggered if he wasn't thinking this through in some detail. I guess there's a couple of things there. First is, yes, there's clearly surging scepticism towards migration in Australia. On the other hand, and, you know, pollsters have pointed this out, you know, our demographics as they shift means the voting base shifts as well. And, you know, there's been a bit of speculation even that the government was not unhappy to have Mr. Modi in Victoria in particular at the moment, rather than, say, in Sydney or in Canberra, because of the state election and because there's a large number of people who will be attending this event who might think very well of Mr. Modi, who might populate some of those outer metropolitan seats in particular in Melbourne, where Labor is facing this incredibly tight three-way battle with the coalition and with One Nation, where it's struggling to survive. So, yes, I think Anthony Albanese would absolutely see political risk in the current climate. I'm sure he'll calibrate his remarks very carefully. But you look at what he said even yesterday when he was speaking about the contribution that Australian Indians have made and how they're fine, upstanding citizens, proud of their heritage, but exceptionally good members of the Australian community, business owners, you know, people who value education. All of this, incidentally, is totally true. He also sees political advantage in this as well as our electorate gets more diverse.
Yeah, and PK, I think that's right. We have really seen, so far, we have seen the government and the Prime Minister lean into multiculturalism in response to the rise of Pauline Hanson at the moment, so far, haven't we? We haven't seen any kind of pullback.
Well, no, we haven't seen a pullback, and that's because the government, I think, rightly identifies that horse has bolted, you know.
Yeah.
When Sarah Ferguson asked him what is multiculturalism, his answer was pretty clear, wasn't it? It's what we are.
It's who we are as Australians. And I thought that Paul Hogan nailed it today as well. We've never been a monocultural society.
I mean, it's not one of these kind of highly contestable concepts. The horse bolted when our demographics started changing as much as they did. And with that many people born overseas, with a parent born overseas, I think the debate is kind of, you know, you've got to consider all these things in that context. There are so many Indian Australians. Like, the Prime Minister knows they vote. And unless the Liberal Party can try and repair its relationship with this community that, remember, was further damaged by Jacinta Nubbajipa Price in that interview with me last year.
Yeah.
Don't forget about that history either. And that puts Labor in the box seat with a community like this, a community that actually has a significant electoral kind of muscle. It's not a nothing community. It's a big community. So
yeah, it's a significant
community. So all of that is in this context, that kind of nationalism that we're seeing from Modi. There's not an over-distancing away from that from the Prime Minister. Now, of course, you know, there are some sensitivities. You heard Andrew Hastie take this third way path, he said to Sarah Ferguson the other night on 7:30 in relation to, you know, you're not a monoculture, you're not a multicultural, like you're something in the middle because you have a national identity as well.
Monoculturalism as put out by Pauline Hanson and multiculturalism as, you know, advocated by some people on the left are both loaded political terms. You've got the woke right pushing for monoculturalism, you've got the woke left pushing for multiculturalism. I sit with most sensible mainstream Australians somewhere in the centre. I think there is a third way.
I get what he's getting at there, the idea of a unity around us as well as our diversity.
But that's what multiculturalism is.
Yeah, yeah,
anyway,
yeah. But obviously, let's not look at it in the weeds. Maybe some people aren't seeing it that way because people like Pauline Hanson have been successful in perhaps tarnishing the concept with some people, which is why you've seen the erosion. Let's get back, though, to the Prime Minister's huge week, which you've been hugely part of, Stephen Gedgetts. We saw a full-throated Pacific push from the Prime Minister. I mean, event after event after event after deal after, like, quite something.
Lucky all those countries are so close, right, in the Pacific.
Yeah, he met with five Pacific leaders in just 3 days. It's been overwhelmingly positive, at least from my vantage point, and it's really led to annoying China. Walk me through it.
Yeah, I mean, if you told me, you know, say 2 years ago that Australia would have two new treaty allies in the Pacific, I would have told you to stop hallucinating, right? I mean, no one would have expected, at least amongst the commentariat, no one would have expected that the government would be able to land an agreement like this. Agreements like the ones with Tuvalu and Nauru, small states, right, where you can absolutely sew up these strategic bargains where you basically say, we'll make some of your decisions for you on the security front in return for, you know, a migration route to Australia or ongoing budget support. Sure, but big players in the Pacific, PNG and Fiji, by far the two biggest countries in the Pacific.
With their own allies, armies.
With their own armies. I mean, maybe I was naive. Maybe I didn't give the government enough credit for its ambition and drive. I would never have expected this to happen. But the government has managed to land these extraordinary agreements. And they are, I think, truly transformational. Yes, there have been missteps. The government has made fumbles along the way. But like when you look at the scorecard at the moment, I really am saying this objectively, it's an impressive list of achievements. And it has changed the architecture in our region in a way that the government believes will be really, really positive. Now, there is a question. Will these agreements hold, right? You've got pieces of paper, but what if the government changes? The government says, well, you know, they're treaty documents. A new government can't just tear it up. Yeah, that's true, but they can ignore it, right? And the institutional, you know, the institutional backing in these countries is a little bit weaker than ours. So it's not a guarantee, you know. But they're also not just pieces of paper. The government has made real strides here.
Stephen, can you help us understand why? I agree with you, the push and emphasis from this government, from the moment it came into government, the Albanese government, on the Pacific has been intense and positive and effective. But why? Why is the government working so hard here? What's the nightmare scenario, if you like, in the Pacific that the Australian government is trying to guard against, protect against?
It's basically a military base or a so-called dual-use facility for China in the Pacific. That's basically what it is. It's China getting a military foothold in the region. And for whatever reason, and I haven't seen the intelligence, but I know for a fact the government is absolutely convinced that that is exactly what China is after. And this is across the whole system. This is not what Anthony Albanese or Pat Conroy or Penny Wong thinks. This is system-wide. This is everyone who works on the Pacific that I've ever spoken to in Canberra. They remain convinced that that is what China is after. And so what we are doing is making sure we have all these checks, whether that's through the Nakamal Agreement, which basically says that, you know, we have not a right to veto, but you know, we have ways to stop China getting into critical infrastructure, which they might turn into a dual-use facility, or with the agreements of Tuvalu and Nauru, where we basically have to tick off anything like that, or the agreement that we've seen with Fiji and with PNG as treaty allies. You know, we are effectively in a position to veto developments like that. This is all about us trying to make sure China can't get a military base, not because it wants to use a military base to attack Australia, but because once it's got that presence, it can then shape the behaviour of Australia, New Zealand and Pacific states much more effectively, much more easily and at a vastly lower cost.
What does that mean? What do you mean when you say shape the behaviour?
Well, if we want to do something that China doesn't like, which can be anything from maintaining an official or semi-official relationship with Taiwan, sending a parliamentary delegation to Taiwan, voting against China at the UN on human rights resolutions, or things that cut directly across China's core interests, we think again. We don't do it because we think, oh, gosh, is this really going to poke the bear or the dragon?
Because they're
in
just
this
over
case.
There now.
They're just there. If they want to hit us, they can do us. Now, what's the prospect of China ever, you know, launching an attack on Australia? I mean, how do you even begin to, you know, calculate? So there are so many permutations in a Taiwan contingency. If Australia joined in with the US in military action against China, entirely plausible. possible, likely. So, you know, there are situations, but for Australia, we just want to preserve as much space as we can. And the best way to maximise the amount of space for manoeuvre as possible is to keep China as far away as we possibly can. Say, if you want to hit us, you've got to do it from your backyard.
Now, significantly, the Oceans of Peace Alliance was signed, but the oceans, you know, did not remain peaceful for long. And this is quite significant. I alluded to it before, but I want to get into it now. China launched a nuclear missile test with a dummy warhead just hours later. It landed in waters near Tuvalu. The Albanese government, of course, quickly labelled this as destabilising, a provocation.
Australia's view is this test is destabilising for the region and raises the risk of miscalculation. We do not believe this test is consistent with the view that Pacific leaders have very clearly expressed, that the Pacific should be an ocean of peace.
They said they'd received insufficient warning of the action. Timing is everything, Stephen. Is this China flexing its muscle, saying, not really into your Pacific blitz, Australia?
I mean, China is not into our Pacific blitz. I am also not personally convinced there is any direct link in terms of the timing. I've spoken to a lot of people about this. China would have spent months planning this out, right? This is about one of three legs in its nuclear triad. What it's saying is with the second leg from the submarine, not just from the land, from a submarine, we can launch an ICBM 800, 1,000 Ks and hit whatever we like. So this is a demonstration of power. I think that is primarily still a signal, not to the Pacific, although there is a bit of signalling there for the Pacific as well. It's really a signal to the US. That's my assessment. And to a degree to Australia. I think linking it directly, I mean, one argument that's been put to me is, oh, China probably had a week-long window and it noticed that it was going to, you know, that week would fall within the Prime Minister's trip to the Pacific. So perhaps they moved it forward or back a couple of days to time it directly on the day, you know, because it was a nice little add-on, right? So in that sense, you know, that is not, I can't prove that one way or another. I guess that's plausible. But to argue that this missile test was a direct response to the Australian treaty with Fiji, I think is parochial. I don't think it's right. That said, the symbolism of it happening on the same day was powerful. And it's honestly, even though the government's very uneasy and worried about what this missile test says about Chinese capabilities, it's gold dust for the government when it's in the Pacific because it makes its argument for it. It makes it easier for the government to say China is a destabilizing actor. And it's a military threat to the region.
It sort of almost locks in what was already happening with these nations. It actually makes them double down.
I won't name the person, but one person said the Chinese missile test was ghastly, and they said, but it was also a cherry on top of the Prime Minister's visit. Now, how a missile test can be a cherry is a question that smarter minds than me can grapple with. But what they're basically saying is that this did our job for us.
Mm. Is there another way of looking at that, though, that it might, yes, I can see that. Yes, we're going to need some more muscle here to help because look what China can do. But also, look what China can do. Maybe we should be nicer to China and closer to China.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Does China, of course, yeah. And that's potentially what China is betting on. We can organise all the, you know, we can organise all the outraged statements that we like.
I'm hopeful, certainly from Australia's perspective. I've made very clear comments, public comments, but we're hoping as well that the nations of the Pacific join together to send a strong message.
I do think it will have symbolic, diplomatic and moral weight, but in the end, hard power is hard power. And China is probably betting that as aghast as Pacific nations are about what they're seeing in their own backyard at the moment, that it will make them think again about crossing China. Not because China's going to launch a nuclear missile into its backyard, but it's a reminder that it's got the capability to devastate any military in the world with this sort of capability. And they're hoping that will shape Pacific behaviour. And it's, you know, it's potentially not a bad bet.
It's a really destabilising time in the world when the Iran war essentially is kicked off again, right? The ceasefire ending, it just kind of reminds you how fragile everything is. Nothing is ever quite resolved. And we're living in genuinely alarming times, right? And so I think that missile test for China was just one of those warning shots about where this is all going. And it really does feed into some of the domestic debates we've been having too. In a moment, actually, Steve, we're going to let you go, but we are going to talk about the outage, because the Telstra outage, of course, has been a huge political story this week. But just want to get you on one element of the outage, which is the national security element that was thrown in. Now, we're going to, you know, explore why that was raised. First by Barnaby Joyce saying, well, I don't know, the Chinese test happened and now this has happened. It's a conspiracy theory because we've got no evidence of it. And then even Angus Taylor allowed it to be sort of discussed.
You know, there's many questions Australians are asking. We saw a provocative and unwelcome missile launch from the PLA yesterday. And I can understand why Australians are drawing that connection. Now, I don't know whether there's any connection or not. I have no idea. But it's no wonder Australians are starting to ask questions like that, including questions about 000 and what's going on there.
The government, Telstra, they're saying there's no evidence of malicious activity. And of course, it's a watching brief like anything is. But it's interesting, isn't it, how it can kind of seep, this national security China stuff can seep into your domestic crises, whatever they might be.
Absolutely. But the thing that I think we've got to remember here is that I'll start by saying this. I don't know, but the government is signalling very clearly at this stage, as you say, PK, there is no evidence of any sort of malicious intent behind this, or that any evidence that any sort of state-based actor launched this. And so that seems to be where it sits. We'll see if that changes, as you say, but that seems to be the initial assessment. And also I note that a lot of independent experts have said it just doesn't have the telltale signs of that. That's their early assessment. So we'll wait and see. That said, it's not surprising, I think, that some people have raised that question. Whether it's responsible to do so in the absence of evidence is another question. But it's unsurprising because we know for a fact, because people like Rachel Noble, one of our former top cyber spooks, have told us that China has been busy laying what Rachel Noble called live ordnance across our critical infrastructure for the last decade or so, perhaps more. So it's been put on the public record by people who do this for a living that China is looking, not just looking, working actively to try and work out how it could cripple and disable our critical infrastructure, like telecommunications, in the event of a conflict where it might feel like it might be in its interest to do that. So it's not outlandish in that sense to ask the question. But of course, there's a broader question, which is, should you raise that prospect until you've got any evidence that that's happening? In this case, it does not look like there is any evidence of that occurring.
Yeah, I think that's well explained, that it's not as if there haven't been warnings that this sort of thing could happen.
Could happen,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, this was clearly a bridge too far. Okay, Stephen, you've brought the Pacific to us in Canberra and Sydney, so we thank you, and so do our listeners. Thanks so much for joining us on The Party Room.
Thanks so much, guys. Really enjoyed it.
Love your style, Stephen. Love your gig too. Imagine being the reporter that gets to travel around the Pacific. Thanks, Stephen. Honestly, PK, how good is Dizzy? So great to have him with us this week when he's really the man on the spot, isn't he?
Yeah, well, that's his nickname, Dizzy. Stephen Jedgetts, of course, not a dizzy man, though, generally very very focused and, you know, really clear-eyed about the risk in our region and what's happened over the last week. He's all over it, really. Let's go back, though, to where we are. Another telco outage, a huge one, in fact.
We are in the middle of a nightmare, PK. Are you back online yet?
I am not. I am half online, half not. So I shouldn't say completely not, but I've been having a hard time making calls still. I don't know why. I've turned off my phone and turned it on a million times. On the Wi-Fi, it works better. Anyway, this isn't about me, Fran. I made it yesterday about my connectivity issues. What it is about is something pretty important, and that is our entire country essentially almost being shut down, train lines, 000 calls being unanswered. A lot of changes were made after the Optus debacle last year. Clearly some are working. I mean, that's very early kind of analysis from me, but some. Annika Wells is the communications minister. She was on leave. A lot of people are on leave around this time of the year. It's school holidays. She came back from leave, conducted a press conference.
I have returned from leave. I'll continue to monitor and act as the situation requires of me. I think any Australian would expect their communication minister to do that.
Where she updated, but I know that after, in the hours after, they realised that this situation was actually worse than we even thought it was, Fran, and kind of a lot of questions about how it could be so after we had the original issue last year and why the 000 issue has still it's been partly resolved, but not entirely, it seems.
And that's a life and death situation, right? But this whole thing, I mean, Telstra is our major carrier. So if Telstra goes out, there are major problems, and it just reminds us all of how reliant we are on our digital devices for everything. Paying for things, sure. Being able to catch the train, for sure. Being able to call our loved ones. I mean, it's just a reminder of the vulnerability of this, which is why our security services are so preoccupied with it always, and there's warnings and warnings and warnings, and government agencies to make sure our businesses get their resilience, their redundancy capacity in place in case this happens. Well, it has happened. There's plenty of blame to go around, PK. I mean, the government after Optus did put in some more safeguards around this. The carriers are meant to have a system set up so that if 000 goes down, then it immediately kicks on to another carrier, which is great, except it didn't quite work that way this time. There's many hundreds of people who couldn't use 000. And guess what? In some cases, in parts of Australia, large parts of Australia, Telstra is the only network. So there is no other network for the 000 call to move on to next. And that raises questions for governments. Do we have to build in separate backup networks here, like we have, you know, backup energy generators in bushfire regions, things like that? So there is certainly those questions. The government did work hard after Optus. It put in place huge penalties. I think it's $30 million. Maybe those penalties need to be bigger to make sure that these big telecommunication companies are spending the money on the resilience built into their networks. Now, Telstra says it did have that capacity. It did have resilience. It did have these backup redundancy core systems in place, but clearly they haven't worked. So, look, nothing can be 100% fail-safe, but governments need to make sure that the penalties are big enough, the companies need to make sure the social license cost is huge enough that they do as much as they can. And I sort of feel like we're still in a learning phase here, really, in this country, that this is not so much a time for political point scoring, but a time for us as a country to try and get this right, and for companies to take their privileged positions more seriously than their profits, if that's the takeout. But whatever it is, it's huge and massive, and everyone has to move quickly here.
Yeah, I think we're learning lots of things, clearly, from this, and it's still unfolding. So we're recording this Thursday morning. We'll get more updates throughout the day. Clearly, a lot more people have been affected. Fran, one of the key questions being asked, of course, is has anyone's life been lost? Has anyone died as a result of not being able to get through to 000? As we record, it could change. We don't have any evidence that that's happened. If that is something that emerges, that's going to be very, very hard. Well, absolutely, just it's going to really smash Telstra, but also be difficult for the government because, of course, after the Optus outage and there were some deaths, you know, that was the big learning, right? Like, we'll never let that happen again. And so the changes clearly have had an impact, but if they're not having enough and there is some evidence of something, you know, happening, and as I say, as we record, that has not yet occurred, but it's a key question, then that's going to be a very, very difficult political issue for the government. Now, the opposition, let's go to the opposition and the way they've dealt with this. I think they got ahead of themselves, right? I mean, this is a crisis. A government gets held to account for a crisis, even if they're not running Telstra. It must be maddening, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, because it's their job.
Yeah, it's their job, with, you know, in terms of the regulation, the policy settings, making sure these companies are held to account, that there is no incentive for them to stuff things up that are catastrophic for us because we rely on them so heavily. So in that context, I reckon the opposition should have sat back and watched the government perhaps potentially stuff it up before going, you know, which often governments do, we know that, before going, half-cocked on a couple of things, including, of course, Sarah Henderson and her now infamous calls to 000. She stood by that. I had an interview with her on Afternoon Briefing. She really doubled down that, you know, she was doing research. It wasn't vexatious.
Well, Patricia, firstly, let me just say that's an outrageous claim. The law relates to those who make hoax calls or vexatious calls, and I am not going to apologise for doing my job.
She wouldn't concede that it was against the law that she'd done that, even though I think the law's pretty clear that you're not meant to call 000 unless you're in an emergency. She was not
Let's
in an emergency.
Let's talk about that. What do you think? Because the government is sort of trying to, you know, make some points here and, you know, share some of the blame. I'm not surprised that the shadow minister would try and call 000 to see if it's working. To me, I mean, I'm kind of with the shadow minister here that's part of her job.
I'm loving it.
Well, she needs to be on top of this, and she has a duty too to spread the community message to people. I kind of think, well, it might be my instinct too. Okay. I didn't know there was a law against it, but I guess you could think you don't want to be clogging up 000. But is one shadow minister making, I don't know how many calls she made, 3 or 4 or whatever it was, to 000 really such a terrible thing?
Apparently it is, according to the emergency services, and that's who we can rely on. I mean, they made it clear that it was in such a crisis that anyone who calls and clogs it up, you know, could. I mean, there's no proof of this, by the way. I put it to Sarah Henderson, but, you know, you wouldn't want to be making a call and, I don't know, potentially clogging a line that someone else who needs it is getting. You know, I'm speaking very literally here. I don't run telecommunications.
I did hear the Ombudsman on Breakfast this morning saying that the issue is that it might have generated then a callback responsibility by the carrier, which means, you know, you're taking a resource away from Telstra that's trying to call back and check in on all these 000 calls that couldn't get through to make sure everyone is safe. So she did say that's a problem, and I guess that's a problem. But, I think a lot has been made of this at a time where I think there's much bigger issues to be talking about.
I think that's right. I'll agree with that. You know, I agree with that broadly. However, I don't think you do your own research with an emergency line. I'm going to stick to that because I just think that's a pretty standard thing. I don't think Sarah Henderson needed to call that line for us to realise that there was a 000 problem either. Yeah, so let's leave that there. I think we already discussed with Stephen Jedgetts, of course, the other issue around raising whether China was involved. I think you made a really good point about us having warnings about foreign actors doing this sort of thing potentially in the future, which is, you know, why I think it's not silly for people to ask questions about the motive. But to entertain it without evidence is never smart for a politician. It's not your job. And that, I think,
well, as Annika Wells said to them, don't make stuff up.
As a general principle, I think when it comes to matters of national security, you shouldn't make stuff up. You've heard from the Telstra acting CEO that there is currently no evidence to suggest that those things are the case. So I think it's irresponsible.
I mean, you're right. It's not a dumb kind of link to make, but these, you know, politicians have responsible positions in our society and they need to be thinking carefully. And I guess you could say the same about Sarah Henderson and 000. But Barnaby Joyce and Angus Taylor are senior politicians, most senior politicians, really. And they should, I think, know better than to put this stuff out in the public domain without checking first. They have access to, you know, government officials and ministers and security agencies to some degree to check these things first. I think that was really jumping the shark.
Yeah, I agree. But you're right, there are bigger issues. Right now, the biggest issue, of course, is people's safety, the ability of our train networks to operate. This is still unfolding and the government's going to, I think, just, you know, crazy call early on. I think we're going to see more reform. I do. Yeah, I think there'll be more to come because the fallout, I think, potentially could be quite ugly. I hope no one's lost their life. So I hope that never breaks as a story. I hope that never happens.
Yeah.
But if it does, when there are lives ever lost, it always ups the stakes. And I imagine, you know, the Telstra boss will be back tomorrow morning. You know, the fact that the minister was able to get home quicker than the Telstra boss. I always think, can I give you one of my controversial ideas?
Yeah.
I always think when you have a really, really senior job, it's best that you learn to holiday in Australia. Have I told you my theory?
This is the Scott Morrison Hawaii theory.
I don't think forever, because I mean, I love going back to Greece, for instance, you know, where my parents are from. But I think if you are a prime minister, deputy prime minister, you know, insert sort of senior roles, Telstra CEO, it's a huge job of an Australian network, then you think, when I finish this
job, don't go skiing in the US.
I'm going to hit the international circuit hard, but while I'm doing this job, Noosa looks nice.
Yeah. Just one last thing I'd say on this, that too, I think as a country, like you said, there's lots of things to learn, but as a country, a rich country, a wealthy country, we should not have a train network that goes down because a Telstra software problem. You know, we have to build in those backup systems. This is, we've got to start treating it like critical infrastructure, because it is.
It is, absolutely. And look at the impact it's had. Just beyond life is the most important, but economically, huge, Fran, right?
Yeah, for individuals.
For just anyone, really, everyone. It's such a big company. Now, let's end this podcast on a note that we can't miss, Fran. I heard actually on Monday Mel and Jacob speak about it on Politics Now. I was away and I listened in, of course, and I think they did a brilliant job talking about the vexed nature of politicians in a new world getting on podcasts, talking with, you know, all sorts of people so that they can get into everyone's algorithm and get into voters' ears. I get why they do it. Albanese is a big fan of this. And I think if you look internationally, there was a big, before the US election, I mean, this was Trump's strategy. He got into everyone's algorithm, right? He was on every long form podcast, Rogan, of course, being the most significant. Albanese does that too. However, he did go on a podcast and ended up talking about his sex life, ended up talking.
Never good.
Wanting to, you know, since essentially his desire for Kylie Minogue. I don't know how Kylie Minogue feels about that. I want to send her chocolates and flowers. Sorry that you had to hear that, Kylie.
Shag, marry, date. Kylie Minogue, Nicole Kidman, or Rhonda Birchmore?
I've just got married. I'm only 6 months in.
But if it goes tits up, let's just pretend.
Oh, Kylie, clearly.
You'd marry Kylie and Shagger and date her?
All of the above.
And, you know, a joke even about the Japanese prime minister and melons, which is the one I most disliked. Some feminists are outraged by it. I mean, I personally don't necessarily see it as an affront to feminism. I see it as an affront to maybe the prime ministership. I know that's a different line, but I don't know. I think girls play games like this. Like, I think.
Yeah, I mean, let's just remind everyone, this is a well-known social media parlor game, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, but it's also just a game people play. Like, you make jokes. I think the problem is that he's a prime minister and that we have a different standard for prime ministers. And we do. There's no. That's just. Yes, we do. You are held to a different standard if you're a prime minister.
I agree. And what troubles me is I don't really understand how our prime minister got himself into this position, because like I say, this is like a well-known social media parlor game, shag, marry, date, shag, marry, kill, whatever it is. Nikki Osborne regularly includes it as part of a shtick, so he must have known it was coming. Can he not think on his feet, our prime minister, in which case that's a worry? Or, you know, let's ask it, did he judge the risk was worth the exposure on this kind of podcast? Because for the audience he's targeting here, a younger, not very politically engaged audience, I'm not sure if it's lads or girls, I'm not sure. But,
girls,
you know,
in this one.
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, that's the question it raises, I think. It's not appropriate. He needed to be able to think on his feet. He would have known it was coming.
Or should have known, because that's, they do,
must
though.
Have known.
No, well, that's what the podcast does.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I mean.
It's literally
must have known.
In the label. Like, it does that. That's, I think it's really vexed, and I think you need to know, you know, what to say yes to and what to say no to. And I'm sure this is a bigger issue for his media team, for everyone, about how to manage things like this. Because as I mentioned, the Rogan case and Trump, it was very, very useful for him. There are times when speaking outside of the political bubble, so to speak, or outside of the press gallery or outside of the shock jocks even, can be useful. But there are always going to be high risks. And this one was, I think, probably too risky. Maybe he thought it would make him seem really relatable. This is, now I'm stealing my 17-year-old's analysis. She's like, I think it's an attempt to be relatable, but we don't need him to be relatable. And I thought that was a really powerful point. Like, we don't need him to be like one of the girls, you know? Like, he's the prime minister.
So, exactly. Like, it's not the brand that we're after from our PM, I don't think.
Yeah. 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 Yes. So, yeah, I mean, it was clearly a fail. We know it was a fail because the sort of yarn here is unequivocal apology. He issued an unequivocal apology. So you don't give one of those unless you know it went wrong. And it's allowed, of course, all these critics to pile on. As I say, some people paint it as sexist. I think the general game, boys and girls play it, I don't know if it's sexist as much as just crude and maybe something you should only do if you're a drunk teenager.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. PK, there's been a lot to talk about. There's a whole nother problem coming for the government, which I think we'll probably get into next week, which is rents. The data that's come out that shows how much rents are rising just in the last month and the last 3 months, you know, they've risen in Sydney, I think, by 6%. That's a lot. And so all the focus, you know, it's on the housing crisis. People kind of get into the housing market. But meanwhile, rents are going up. The government's likely to get blamed for it, even though it's probably more to do with things like rising interest rates and the lack of housing that's being built. But I think this is going to be a really big one for the government, and they're going to have to be forced to do more on this. I'm not sure what that looks like, but I just flag it as something we're going to be talking about in the weeks to come, I reckon.
That's it for The Party Room today, but keep sending your questions in. We love getting them. Send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Jacob Greber will be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday, and then PK, you're back with Politics Now on Monday.
That's right. And remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.